the Indiana Chamber's Economic Vision Plan, Rokita on Religious Expression, plus College Sports Realignment, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 11th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana Chamber of Commerce leaders said the state is a lap or two behind its competition when it comes to workforce development and educational attainment. The Chamber unveiled its new economic vision plan for the next dozen years, laying out the ways it thinks Indiana must move to succeed. The Chamber's plan extends some of the goals it set in previous plans. For example, it wants 70% of the state earning some sort of post-secondary degree or certificate by 2035. Its previous target was 60% by 2025, which Indiana will almost certainly not meet. Chamber President Kevin Briniger says the state also needs more than 90% of its students reading proficient by third grade. It's currently less than 82%.
If Indiana excelled in addressing every other goal outlined in this plan, but failed to make significant progress in the workforce and education goals, it's highly doubtful that Indiana's economy will hold its place.
The Chamber says its goals will influence what it advocates for over the next decade with legislators and policymakers. Are the Chamber's goals achievable? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, obviously the Chamber wants to set lofty goals, but are they achievable?
Well, to the extent they're going to require legislation to pass, then yeah. I mean, right? That was Republican supermajority, the very pro-Chamber. And they should set a high standard, I think. There's a little bit of fatigue around the State House around workforce. I mean, this hasn't been for lack of trying to move kids into higher ed, to train them up, skill them up.
Yeah, not just the traditional 4-year or 2-year colleges.
Right, it's also
certificates, all that. Yeah.
Reorienting the high school curriculum so the basics are out of the way in their first 2 years, and then you have more of a career oriented, finish to your high school career. There's been a lot happening, a lot more needs to happen because we're coming up short of what the old goals were. But again, there is a little bit of fatigue in the State House, just thinking about the legislature, of the kind of constant retooling of the workforce cabinet, all these workforce programs that we're trying to put in, the money that goes behind that training. But it's not something they can ignore either, which is why it's constantly on the front burner.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the goals that they set in this new economic plan or vision plan were a lot like the old goals. They're just moving them even further down moving the goalposts, but in a progressive way, I guess you'd put it. But they haven't hit the old ones yet.
No, they haven't.
And so are these achievable?
Oh, I think they're achievable. There's nothing about the population of Indiana that's any less intelligent than the population of any other state. So, yes, they're achievable. The question is there a will on the part of the legislature to put the money where it needs to go? It was a big step forward. Automatically enrolling people in the 21st Century Scholars Program. That was a big step forward. But we've got to start earlier. We've got to have preschool and kindergarten for all of these kids if we're going to stay competitive with other states that already have it and ingrain in those children the notion that, getting out of high school or getting a GED is not the goal. The goal is something that'll give you a career that'll support a family. And we've got to start doing that much younger. And that means the allocation of resources, not in little tiny steps, which is what the legislature and the governor do. We should have mandatory kindergarten, number one, and we should have preschool available to everybody who wants it. And if we do that, in addition to expanding the 21st Century Scholars Program, we're going to do a lot to getting to those goals.
You know, Mike said the legislature has been very pro-chamber. I think that's undoubtedly true over the last decade plus.
And they've Except created, on social they, issues.
That's my question. So they've created this tax and business climate that is the envy of most other states, undoubtedly leading in the Midwest, one of the leaders in the country, and that has paid some dividends. We've seen major companies move to Indiana or expand in Indiana. But we are meeting a sort of bulkhead here of now we're struggling to get people to come to this state or stay in this state because they don't perceive it as an attractive place to live. And the chamber is very aware of that, and that's part of one of its pillars on its new plan. But is the legislature willing to go there?
Well, I think they're willing to go there on things like quality of place. You've seen that in the ready grants they've done, you know, because that improves things like broadband or parks or housing, or like they have stretched out a little bit in that manner. Now, in terms of political climate, inclusivity, I don't think they're quite ready for that if you mean changing sort of how we approach drawing people here. I mean, quality of place, yes, but they're certainly not going to change their conservative, you know, philosophies in order to try to attract a younger, you know, more diverse population.
More educated population.
And so if that's the case, and I agree, is there sort of a ceiling for Indiana in terms of how much of its workforce it can attract and retain?
Well, that assumes that the legislature and its belief system will always be rigid and be a constant static force. One could argue that if it becomes apparent that that thinking is an impediment to economic growth, one could foresee a situation where the legislature's makeup changes and become. Now, there's a lot of ifs there, and it would have to be pretty pronounced for Hoosiers to say, what's the roadblock that's preventing us from getting the jobs that are going to Texas or Georgia or whatever the hot spots are? And if it's shown that this is the impediment, this is the roadblock, well, maybe it would take something like that to change. But, you know, I wouldn't always say that this legislature is in lockstep, though, with you pointed out some of the social issues, taxation over tobacco products and smoking. I mean, that's been on the front burner issue for the chamber and many other large employers for years. COVID, we saw quite on terms of workplace rights or employer rights, we saw quite a schism there too. So there are areas where there's a bit of division. I was taken with the metaphor of the laps. We're a lap or two behind. The real trouble is, to use the flag racing, the racing flag metaphor, is when we get the blue flag with the orange stripe, which means there's faster traffic, you better pull over, they're trying to pass you, that's when we're in trouble, because other states ostensibly are going to be eating our lunch, if you will.
The money still matters in this. There's high-profile examples in the wake of RFRA, in the wake of gay marriage, in the wake of transgender bills, of Eli Lilly is now the most valuable healthcare company on the planet, and they're expanding in Indiana.
And elsewhere.
Well, sure, everybody is. Cummins too, overseas and in other places. Salesforce was the biggest opponent of RFRA, and then they bought the biggest building in the state and put their name on the side of it. So the ESG companies that are making ESG decisions, they're only making them until the investors start pulling back or start putting limits on it.
Yeah, but look at Lilly's leadership.
It's more gray, and
it has been sounded there.
I'm socially, you know, progressive, but even I look at it and go, this is more of a mixed bag in the decisions that are being made here than just.
And it's also harder
to
draw the straight line.
It is also, though, how much publicity goes with it. RFRA hit, you know, the NCAA and everything else all at once.
And then
they got national.
And then we had to say pull back.
They had to, because they were a laughing stock.
And we haven't seen an impact like that with any of the other states.
Because there are too many other Republican-controlled states doing the same kind of thing at the moment.
All right. Well, as students head back to school, Attorney General Todd Rokita this week updated his so-called Parents' Bill of Rights with a focus on religious expression in the classroom. Rokita initially created the documents 2 years ago to, in part, condemn teaching about race in schools. It was sharply criticized at the time as a political tool aimed at stirring division. Rokita maintains it's about helping inform Hoosier parents about their rights related to education, and his office has updated it multiple times since its creation, including sections about vaccinations and private school vouchers. The latest update answers questions about how religion and education intersect. In a Facebook Live event Tuesday, Rokita laid out what is allowed, such as students praying at school as long as it doesn't interfere with instruction, and what's not.
What is prohibited in schools is, public schools, is teacher or school official as arms of the government, government-led practice of a particular religion.
The document, which is laid out in a frequently asked questions format, cites state law and U.S. Supreme Court precedents for how religious expression is treated in the school environment. And Delaney, Rokita was asked about the separation of church and state as part of this discussion, and he called it a myth, saying what the Constitution says is it simply provides that the government doesn't establish any one particular religion.
Well, maybe he should read the entire amendment, okay? Because I first of all, would never go to him for any advice on constitutional law. But the point is, you can't coerce, all right? And if it's authorized by a teacher for a student to lead in a prayer, that gets very close to the Establishment Clause. Yeah. It does. And all students can pray in class right now. Yeah. I mean, who didn't say a prayer before an important test? That's absolutely, it's not only prohibited, it's encouraged. This kind of stuff is the same kind of thing that he does all the time. He looks for excuses to get out there and to appeal to his right-wing base in the party. Nobody with any sense thinks that it's good in a public school to try to coerce people into one system of belief, okay? Everybody should be free to practice his or her religion as they see fit. And that's why it's done privately in the school environment. If there's a club they want to have of Christians or Muslims or Jews and do that on their spare time after class is over, fine. No problem with that. But you can't be doing something where other students who are not comfortable with that type of religion or that type of approach have to sit there or feel somehow that there's something wrong with them or that people will look down on them because they do that. And that's the law, and it is the reason is pretty clear. Our founding fathers did not want a religion that served all and that everyone had to serve. And that's perilously close to where our attorney general comes.
We've talked before on this show about his parents' Bill of Rights, the first edition of which was the most controversial, where he was sort of putting out more of his opinion than necessarily the legal analysis we saw in this section. As this Bill of Rights, that he calls it, goes, this one's fairly straightforward and uncontroversial, is that fair?
It's not unhelpful to have this document. You know, it's not unhelpful for parents to have a resource where they can go, how do I transition a kid out of a traditional public school and into a charter school? What does that mean for me financially? How do I qualify? You know, those types of things. But because it's Todd Rokita, it's dripping in hyperbole, if you just stopped it, here's a very helpful resource. That'd be great. But it's not. It's us versus them. It's like, here's this document because they're trying to indoctrinate you. And that's where everyone's just like kind of done. And that's why it doesn't get anywhere. That's why there's no credibility to this exercise in terms of educating parents, because it creates this parallel political dynamic that you just can't help but tee
stoke
up and just turn people against each other at school board meetings. And he thinks that's all great, that parents are showing up and yelling at volunteer school board members.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, to that end, does that limit the effectiveness of something like this?
Well, it depends. When you're trying to determine effectiveness, I guess you have to say, what is the goal? Is the goal to actually see some kind of legislative change, statutory change, a practical change in process? No, it won't be, for the reasons Mike outlined very well. There isn't an appetite for that. If, however, the goal is one of self-aggrandizement or one where the person who's espousing this Bill of Rights together is looking to gin up what he perceives as his base, which is the faction that might go and yell to a certain extent at the volunteer school board members or think that there's some sort of Marxist, you know, satanic cabal.
Careful, they'll get the angry emails.
I know. I do get a lot of those, and my poor son with the same name gets them first, though, usually. But that if your goal is that, well, then you can probably get people to be enthusiastic and to say your name, and Todd Rokita is our standard bearer and leading the charge. So you have to ask the question, what's the goal?
I did note, though, you mentioned the idea of legislative change or some sort of change. In a lot of this document, he answers the question with a fairly solid legal analysis. I mean, no question about that. In some of the questions, though, there's an extra, and it's bolded out because he wants to identify that it's separate. It's not, you know, here is what the status quo is. It's, well, but if you want to change it, here's what you would have to do to change it. The example he used was a question about COVID vaccines and FDA approval and what that means for students. And in that particular question at the bottom, but if you think vaccines should be, no vaccine should be mandated for students, you contact your legislature, your legislator, and do this. In this entire religious expression session, nothing like that. So again, is this the least sort of controversial of all of them?
Yeah, I mean, 95% of that was very fact-based and, you know, useful information for all parents. It's not targeted to all parents, and I think that's why half the parents will immediately turn it off, is because they feel like it's trying to target them as being too progressive or something. But a lot of it, you know, how your school board works, what the new laws are on library books, yeah, you know, things like that, we're all very fact-based. It's just, you know, I agree with everyone that he has trouble just putting the facts out there and not following it up with very, you know, hyperbolic wording. And in
certain Bibles, the words of Christ, I believe, appear in a different typeface. They might be red or they might be bold. Oh. I'll let you draw your own conclusions.
Oh, God.
This is something we don't get to talk about on the show very often, so I'm excited. Not that. This.
No.
Unfortunately, that.
This, which is Division I college athletics. They underwent significant upheaval this week as another round of conference realignment changed the face of college sports, including major changes to the Big Ten. The dominoes began with the Big Ten, a conference historically associated with the Midwest and home to Purdue and Indiana universities. It added Washington and Oregon from the Pac-12 conference to its ranks after agreeing last year to add the University of Southern California and the University of California, Los Angeles. That triggered Arizona, Arizona State, and Utah to flee the Pac-12 conference for the Big 12, which had already lured Colorado from that same conference. And in the span of just a few hours, the Pac-12, which existed for more than six decades, was gone.
John Schwanes, this is all about college football. Has any thought been given by all of these college officials to the student athletes, who don't play college football?
Probably not as much as you would hope or would think. Since it's those non-football...
Well, I think almost none, so probably...
Well, it's the non-football players that make up, even though football is the revenue sport, the
Absolutely.
Primary revenue sport, and gets a lot of attention and is driving this. If you look at on a percentage basis, that's a small fraction of the sports participating student body. And so others, though, maybe not the decision makers, because this is happening so fast. I mean, you saw the scramble over the past week or two. There hasn't been time or thought. It's almost a desperation sort of, you know, here, well, let's align with you and maybe we can save our bacon if we... But others are starting to look at it, because you do look at the non-rev sports and these other sorts of things, which I saw an example. Somebody was looking at the longest trip, and it would be for, say, in this case, a soccer team, either from USC or UCLA playing in Rutgers or vice versa. Now, a lot of the marquee programs, football programs, have their private aircraft that they all fly and they can go nonstop. For the non-revenue,
team doesn't have that.
The non-revenue right. sports, they're flying commercial.
Yeah, and they're not flying first class.
And I don't know how many. Maybe there are some Rutgers, maybe Newark. I don't know. I guess you probably fly into Newark. But chances are there will be delays. There will be baggage claim. There will be it's not as expeditious as getting on your private aircraft. Everything's loaded on there for you and taken off. So
and
it
again,
is going to encroach, I presume, on this thing that sort of quaint in hindsight, studying and,
yeah,
and academics.
Yeah, and that's, so, you know, there's the perception, there's been the perception of college sports, particularly in football and basketball, of, well, are they really student athletes or are they really just athletes? Well, in most of the sports that most people play in colleges and universities in the country,
they are students
who happen to be athletes.
Correct.
And doesn't this put them the most in trouble?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think this is ridiculous at this point. And the fact that the NCAA hasn't stepped in some way to say, look, you know, you can't be having students travel more than X number of miles.
I
mean, the NCAA, I'm not sure what it is the NCAA does other than punish students for
some limits on how often these kids are traveling, how far they're traveling. I mean, at some point you mentioned, you know, how everyone just sort of reacted in the last couple of weeks. I felt like it was like in gym class and you were trying to get picked for the team. You didn't want to be the last one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and part of this is, so Stanford University, well, I'm not going to go crying for people who get to go to Stanford, but Stanford University has won what they call, I think it's called the College Cup a lot, which is they have the most collective championships per year across every single sport. Stanford wins that all the time, and they're left without a conference at the moment, which, if that doesn't reveal how stupid this all is, I'm not sure
they
what
they can join
does.
Notre Dame.
But, yeah.
Yeah, they can play Notre Dame.
Well, there's a West Coast Ivy League being floated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, speaking of Notre Dame, Muffet McGraw, the former women's basketball coach there, floated the idea this week of, in the wake of all this, let's separate football out. You can do whatever you want with whatever conferences you want in football. Basically, make your own league. It's amateur or whatever, but make your own league. And then everybody else go back to the conferences they used to be in.
That makes
a lot
of sense.
With the rivalries that mattered, with the regionalism that mattered.
Makes a lot of sense. And the other thing it would do is, football is a revenue generator.
It is.
And if that trickles down to the
other,
well, you have to win to get revenue. But if it trickles down to the other sports, it may make it a lot easier for all the real student athletes to participate and to travel, maybe not quite like the football players, but better than they have been.
Going back to something Nikki said, is the biggest issue here that as we see this now play out over the next few years, because this doesn't all happen instantly, but as we see this play out, if there are some pretty negative consequences for non-football athletes, is the biggest problem that the NCAA doesn't seem to have the power to do anything?
Not over. This is all happening organically,
yeah.
But it's all being driven by TV deals.
Right.
In football,
yep.
And in part in basketball, but primarily football. This, yep. The Big 12 is easily disintegrated.
Yeah.
But they beat the Pac-12 in their TV deal.
They did.
But all this is changing. I mean, and it's all going to be – I'll be interested when we have these super conferences, if we kind of go back almost in reverse and, like, break them out by division and region. And
yeah.
It'd be like the AFC and the NFC and the NFL,
yeah.
right? And then you at least break it down kind of by region.
Or the American League.
But there's a clear path to championship, too.
NCAA has drawn lines in the sand before on issues such as gambling, on issues such as
for the longest time, name and image.
Yeah,
likeness.
Oh, use
right.
I mean, the paying of and basically they ended up a defendant in long-running
sure
lawsuits.
They
spent years in court.
So the other big deal this week was Barstool getting out of gaming because Penn is going to partner with ESPN and Disney.
Yeah.
So now Disney's getting in the sportsbook game, which is going to...
You can go on their cruises with the kids and make...
Watching
ESPN is
going to be... I mean, it's going to be an experience in odd-making.
Yeah.
Well, it already...
And moving.
It already pretty much was, and now it really will be. All right. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is... Is the latest round of college sports conference realignment good for student athletes? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you if the indictment of Donald Trump III makes him more or less likely to become the Republican nominee for president. 25% said more likely, 40% said less likely, and 35% said there wasn't any change. I was interested in the results of that one. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the State Budget Committee this week approved a request from the Indiana Economic Development Corporation for $120 million to help land an advanced auto manufacturing plant. And that's about as much information about the company as the IEDC will share. The IEDC says the company would invest $3.2 billion and potentially create almost 1,400 jobs. But the agency declined to share more about the company, including its name, citing concerns about public disclosure and shareholder interests. The money comes from a new deal closing fund lawmakers created for the IEDC, and the agency notes that if the company doesn't end up locating in Indiana, the $120 million will simply go back into that fund. Democrats raised concerns about the lack of transparency and questioned the return on investment for such dollars. Nikki, is the secrecy just the reality of economic development here?
Yeah, and lawmakers, especially Republicans, seem okay with that. I mean, they sign little non-disclosure agreements so they can get the details, but the public, whose money it is, they still don't get to know. And that apparently is the way it's going to go. One heartening thing is they're burning through that money pretty fast that they gave them in that budget, so we'll only have a couple more months of this before they're out of it.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, $500 million for the steel closing fund, $120 million already out the door. We hope it works, and so that money is gone, but I mean...
Think of how many preschool kids we could have with that.
What is the end? Like, what is the future of this?
You know, the future, I guess, it will be in the proof is in the pudding. If we get a lot of these job-bearing facilities, people are probably willing to forego transparency. If this turns out to be a boondoggle and it seems money was ill-spent, well, then there might be some pushback. Keep in mind that government works best. I mean, this is going to sound, I'm not advocating this, but when you get voters and pesky taxpayers out of the way, you can really be effective as a government entity.
Yeah.
The question is, at what price is effectiveness? I mean, we are a democracy. We are based on taxpayer funding. We do should have a stake in this.
Is really the biggest problem here that we won't know if this was all worth it for
till the money's spent.
Years and years and years down the line.
And how much are we, like, $120 million for what, 1,400 jobs? You know, like, how much are we spending per job?
Per job.
Yeah. Yeah, but
and do those jobs ever come to fruition? That, I think, is the
some
biggest
of the, some of the incentives are determined
can be clawed
by
back.
And is there a cottage industry that when you have large manufacturing plants, a lot of times you'll see almost a secondary and third sort of
that's what they pay, too.
Right. Yeah. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.